Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Ram Castillo, welcome to Inside Out.
Billy, thank you so much for having me, mate. Appreciate you.
Oh, man, I'm so excited. All right, we're going to get going with this. What is the significance of this as you think back in your childhood? And maybe describe what this is for those who are just listening in.
So Billy's just held up a toilet paper roll, cardboard toilet paper roll. That can be described as many different things, depending where you are.
Dunny paper, I believe, down under, right?
Yeah, that's right, right. Dunny paper, dunny roll, bog roll sometimes as well. But so the story behind that is I grew up not so well off, but even beyond that, my story begins way before me. My parents are from the Philippines. My dad's one of 11. Mum's one of five. Dad grew up with his father passing away when he was only 3 years old. And he would wake up at 4 a.m. and carry bags of rice on his head to help his mum with the sort of local eatery. Wouldn't even call it a full-blown restaurant, but they would often even have only a tablespoon of peanut butter and bread to share for the day. And that's not to share and emphasize necessarily, you know, the feelings of sympathy that you might get from a story like that, but just the reality of their life. Like literally when people have a hard time there, in our view, in their view, it's just survival. You just get on with it. So he used education as a tool to, quote unquote, sort of get out of that life as a way to build a better one. My mom, she grew up with a father that was never really around, like straight into it. He was quite abusive. He was a womanizer. He just wasn't there for his family. So pretty much my mom grew up with four other siblings, five of them in total, with a single mom. And she had, my grandma, she had a corner store selling cartons of milk divided into bags, just, you know, none of this, a carton each, but the local neighborhood would get portions of that carton. And she would sew dresses and dressmake out the back just to make ends meet. And so the heartbreaking thing as well is they did get the education. My dad got marine transportation degree and mechanical and engineering degrees, two degrees. We get to Australia, I'm a one-year-old baby. And none of those degrees are recognized in Australia. So I'm from Sydney. And so I always think, gosh, I had a close shave there. I could have lived that life. I could have. Any one of us could have, to be fair, right? We don't choose where we're born or where we, you know, where we just begin our lives. Totally. So I'm always grateful of that. But the toilet paper roll was because I would collect empty tissue boxes, toilet paper rolls, cardboard material. And I would build robots, cities. Obviously, we didn't have iPads or anything back then. So I would just make stuff. And my mom, I remember one moment where we were in our little apartment. She's cooking spaghetti and I can almost still remember the smell of it. And she said, Ram, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would have been about 5 years old, a bit distracted with my toilet paper rolls. And she's like, stops cooking, comes to me, put her hand on my shoulder and says, she says, well, look, whatever you want to be, whatever you want to become, just make sure you dream big. Make sure you dream much, much bigger. Because I think I mumbled something like, I just want to make stuff, right? And here I am, mid-30s, have lived a life where I'm able to reverse engineer desired outcomes for people in the entrepreneurial and business space, having done so through the lens of being a designer primarily. So I ended up finishing graphic design, but even then it was tough because I didn't really know if we could afford to pursue that realistically. You know, dream big sure sounds good, but like we didn't really have much. And so I'll park it there, Billy, if you want me to unpack that story with the getting towards the design life that I live now and the business world because of that, more than welcome to.
Yeah, no, I can't wait to explore all of that. Your parents were super influential to you, and I love that part of your story, and it's almost like you're reading my notes, because the next place I was going to go was your mom telling you to dream big, and that right there is so powerful. So as you think about the fact that she instilled this belief in you at a very young age to dream big, how is that playing out, or has that played out in your life today? If you could think through and really reflect about that being a pivotal moment in your life, an insightful moment that today you've traveled the world, you're doing amazing things. How did that play a role in all of those things?
Great question, Billy. Two things come to mind straight off the bat. The first is, an interesting thing happens when someone believes in you, encourages you at such a young age. So I always ask myself, even now, what are the thoughts and beliefs that have led you to behave the way you've been behaving? And through the power of hindsight and reflection, I often think that I was enabled to be on a different baseline. Now, that's not to say that I was in particularly, you know, destined for this path or special in any way, because the second thing I was going to say was the immensity of our goals and dreams must be matched with the intensity of our actions. So sure, you can dream big, but you still have to move. You still have to put in the exactly. Put in the work. So those two things. But going back to the first thing, what my parents did was they didn't enforce or limit or put me in a box. The beautiful thing about saying something like that, to dream big, is to allow people to imagine a world that hasn't happened yet, to imagine possibility. And I often think, and a lot of creative people talk about this, where it's not that people are not born creative, it's that they don't hold on to that creativity as we grow older.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I emphasize creativity is because in a world so dire with critical challenges to resolve, from sustainability to ethical and diverse businesses, and anything from inclusion and diversity right through to, you know, creating equal opportunity, like there's a gamut of problems that we can all solve, and a key part of that is creativity. And so I think that the main thing is to be surrounded by people, places, and things that allow and enable you to not be afraid to fail, not be afraid to try things. Because I'll be honest, how it played out was, anytime I had a crazy idea or anytime I wanted to try something, my mum would just go for it. Literally, she would be like, go for it. Like no sort of trying to pull me back. Not to say that I didn't know the dangers, because they made it clear that whatever path you choose, there's going to be consequences for that.
Sure.
But for example, right, like I would always draw on the wall. Literally, I would draw on the wall. Most parents would be like, no, stop that. What are you doing? My mom's like, well, here's a soapy bucket and towel to clean it up. But like, you're responsible for what you do. It also played out in a couple ways. So you mentioned, you know, I travel a lot. I've spoken around the world. I've written two books. I did two USA tours as part of that, 22 cities in 3 months for each tour. And when I came back from my first tour, which was part of launching my first book, my mom picked me up at the airport with my dad, and I hadn't seen them for 3 months. So they wanted to see me as well, I would imagine. And she said, how does it feel, Ram? How does it feel to climb up that mountain? Because I'd never done that before. No one in our family or generation ever has. And I looked at her and I said, feels pretty good, Mom. And then she said, will make sure you come back down from that mountain and share to everyone what you found. And, you know, she has kept my head in the clouds, but reminded me to keep my feet on the ground. That is the power of those words that she said when she said, dream big and go for it. But it's certainly not without responsibility and action.
It makes perfect sense. And I love the fact that she keeps you grounded while also empowering you to have unlimited thinking and believe in yourself, maybe even more than you would naturally. And what a great lesson as a parent that she taught you, that she modeled for you. So your childhood wasn't perfect. To your own admission, you obviously, being the fact that you came here at 1 year old, you also weren't the biggest guy. I'm a short guy too. You weren't the best student. You weren't necessarily the best athlete. You always loved art. And you did get bullied. So I want to talk about that for a moment. How did that influence who you are today? And the one thing I think of as I say that is the title of your podcast, Giant Thinkers. So I'm just curious if that strikes a chord, if that at all relates at all, but I'm curious, you know, what that being bullied as a child did to you now as you reflect as an adult.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, Billy, because I'm certainly an advocate for general well-being, and not just that, but like keeping it super raw and real. And I'll put it this way. I felt like when I was at home, I was safe and I was loved and I was, it was like Narnia for me, honestly. Like, but the thing is, we didn't have much, but I didn't know we didn't have much because of the enormous love and care that my parents gave me. And when I say that, I mean, like, I didn't change my shoes because we couldn't afford to change it for, you know, every two and a half years. Whereas every year, most kids would get new shoes every year. And I would just wear them until literally it had holes in them and it was falling apart. But right. It didn't bother me. When I was in primary school, I was the shortest in school, and throughout high school too, I was the second shortest in high school. But generally, I was never the most athletic. I was never the most intelligent, never the most wealthy, never the most good looking, none of that. Right? Always in the friend zone, right? But in primary school, I actually got bullied quite severely. I had my arm broken 3 times and got 16 stitches before the age of 11.
Wow.
And people are like, what? And I was like, yeah, like that's the experience that I had. How has it affected me now? I believe that I will always be processing it. How I've responded to it, I feel, has been positive to a point, because we don't know the other paths that we didn't choose, number one.
Sure.
But I've also seen flashes of how I could have responded. I believe that my parents played a big part in that conscious decision making. I now have felt that I have an awareness that allows me to be in touch with that consciousness. And so the questions that I've been asking myself when people say, wow, you've done so much, or my last role was head of digital design at Saatchi & Saatchi in Australia and working for AMX, Qantas, Toyota. Like, these were the dreams that I had. I bought my first property at the age of 27. You know, these are the things that, again, my family, my ancestors could never dream of. Like, I broke away from what was possible, you know, starting businesses. Now I'm now an advisor to multiple businesses. I sit on the advisory board for companies. I own a lot of companies and invest. And it's like, what happened? And what it came down to was that at the beginning, it was suck eggs to the bullies. But now it's about impact. It's about meaningful dialogue. I wouldn't say it's exactly legacy. I don't think I'm there yet, because I'll be honest with you. I don't I feel like I'm still wanting to find out, you know, what that even means or how that could look like. But it all comes down to going down your own truth barrel, really going down your own truth barrel. And I'm talking about what is the expression of your gifts, because everything that I've done and chosen, I felt was helping my younger self. And so when entrepreneurs think about what's the opportunity that I actually commit to, I think the question they need to ask is, what am I really looking to achieve? What does that actually look like? How do I know that I've achieved it? Because the question that I was asking myself was, well, why do you even exist? As big as that question sounds, and although I might not have the complete answer for that, what drives me is leading with generosity and following with care, because I've had little and I've had a lot and I've had everything in between. And if, you know, a question I get a lot is, you know, what does success mean to you? I get that in Q&A all the time. What does success, how do you define success? And my working definition is actually quite simple, and it comes down to this: how well I go to sleep at night, because that's where I'm at. But I've had nights where, you know, I realized, you know, when I'm building up and climbing up the career ladder, I've realized climbing up this ladder of success, it could actually be leaning against the wrong wall. Mm. That's a bloody terrifying feeling. So I think it's a transition, though, you know, internal factors, external factors. It's a lot of inner work that goes into getting through trauma of any type, but that's only just a little bit of it, you know. And I think that's the other thing. We don't really know the story of another. So if someone reads something like my bio,
that's so true.
I often also, and I said something like this recently in pieces of my content, but it was around, I believe the level of success of a person, of our perception of that level of success, is certainly not just career or professional life, but values they hold. But the level of success of a person that we view as successful is in proportion to the number of difficult conversations they've had with others and with themselves, and the tolerance and the patience and the resilience that they have. I mean, I could only imagine, like, you know, your Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos's of the world. But one of the things Jeff Bezos said that I love, he said, you know, in a famous quote of his, if you really cannot tolerate criticism, then don't do anything new or interesting.
I love that.
So, yeah.
Well, man, I mean, look, your story is still being written. It's probably why you don't know the answer fully to the legacy question. I think you're still writing it. And your story, you started in the mailroom. So let's go back there, and then we're going to get into all the things that you're doing now. But let's start with the mailroom. What was the biggest lesson you learned there?
All right. So I knew I wanted to do something in art only because my grades were shit everywhere else in every subject. I mean, I tried, right? Like I don't know if that's a word. I'm a trier. I try stuff. And like, even if I didn't, cause my parents, like, I didn't feel like I was like doing anything. I just enjoyed trying. And I'm talking like I was picked in the C grade, not even the B grade, the C grade of sports that I tried: soccer, tennis, basketball, whatever. But I just like trying, right? But how this loops in to your question about the mailroom is, the only thing that I really gravitated towards was art, because that was the subject in school that I could exercise creativity and I did very well. And so my careers advisor already knew and tried to like encourage me to pursue graphic design, because that was the only commercialized artistry that was available back then in sort of the realm that I was interested in. So come, you know, towards the end of high school, I had to consider, where could I go? But I'm not the smartest kid in the room. So I was really not in pole position to get into design in universities that I wanted to go to. I'll just put it that way. So I applied for a whole bunch of scholarships. There's one design school that I really wanted to go to, the top dog. At the time, it was about $45,000. And this was back in 2003, right? We're talking 17 plus years ago. And I wanted to go there. I applied for a bunch of scholarships. I couldn't afford to go there to the one that I really wanted to. Now that's the same degree is worth like 90 plus thousand. So it was renowned, you know. It was like, you know, you want to go there. Right. You wanted to be with the best of the best kind of thing. But my parents could not afford even a fraction of that. No way. Long and the short of it is I ended up, I'll put it this way. We had grade 10 work experience, and backtracking a bit, I ended up calling, we had the white pages back then. So we would like literally look at this thick book, and I would, we had to find our own place to get work placement too. But I knew, I was like, I want to go work at a design place, whatever. I tried like 99 different places, and I was up to letter W, and I was going to go to my careers advisor, and I said, I don't have no luck. I'm just putting me anywhere. You know, it's mandatory 2-week work experience. Like, to put me anywhere. No one wants me. And he goes, well, where did you get up to? I said, letter W. And he goes, well, I'll sit with you. We'll make some more phone calls. I call this one. It said Wingrove Design. I go, hey, did the whole script thing. I'm like, hey, I'm from this school. I'm in grade 10. I need work experience. Like, as part of our curriculum, we have to find a place. Da, da, da. And he's like, cool. He goes, well, you sound like a really good guy. My name's Ian. And this is my studio. And when do you need to start? I go, oh, it's pretty tight, like next week. And he's like, yeah, cool, come on in. And I was like, wow, that was almost too easy, right? And then the careers advisor's like, see, what did I tell you? In my head, I'm like, yeah, sure, you're probably saying that. You would have said that no matter how far we went in. But so I get to this place, Wingrove Design, and it's beautiful. And there's like magazines on the coffee table, beautiful typography books. I'm 20 minutes early, eager beaver. And then this guy ends up coming in, drops his skateboard on the ground, on the floorboards, and then he's skating inside, and then he makes his way towards me, and he says, hey, you must be Ram. I said, hey, Ian. And he goes, yeah, yeah, this is my studio. He goes, welcome. And I'm like, freaking cool. This is cool. He was working on Sydney Olympics branding. He was working on like Vogue cover shoots, and he was working a whole bunch of stuff where I was like, wow, this is amazing.
So cool.
And so that happens. It's significant later. So then I just keep in touch with him once a year, so send him a message or an email. So I end up completing high school. I get a scholarship to study at a no-name brand college. Like, it's not even known for offering design. I take it because I'm like, it's still qualification and they're paying for it. So did that. And then I got a job in the mailroom. And then everyone was like, why are you taking a job in the mailroom? Like, you're better than that. And in my head, I'm like, no, actually, I think this is the best decision I could ever make. See, they were thinking of the transaction. I was thinking of the transformation of the long term. And in my head, I was like thinking of our other currencies. Mind you, I was getting like seriously low paid. Like, I would get more by working at McDonald's, put it that way. Be the mail boy. I will meet 350 people in the first week over four levels.
And everybody gets mail.
Right, exactly. And this is at Ogilvy as well. So we're talking like, this isn't just a small agency. This is one of the world's largest agencies in the world. And at the time, the Australian division anyway, had everything from Coke to KFC to Amex to Dove to Telstra, which is the biggest mobile network platform here. Anyway, all the big brands. But I was in the mailroom. I knew everyone's name. I would scrub the toilet if it needed to be done. I would change light bulbs. I would order printer toner. I would stack the fridges. I'd be everyone's errand boy. And I was a fly on the wall. But here's the thing. Because I was a fly on the wall, I was exposed to every single department. I was exposed to process. I was exposed to what good looks like. I was exposed to strategy. I was exposed to briefs. I was exposed to mentors. The list goes on with that. And so I was at Ogilvy in the mailroom, and that's how I started out. And then worked my way through. Why I told you the Ian Wingrove story was because in my early years, so after that, I got poached by a smaller agency, and that didn't last too long because they lost the Adidas account. But at that time, and that's when I was like worried, I get a call from Ian after like 6 or 7 years, and he says, "Hey Ram, did you end up pursuing design? And you know, I know we sent emails here and there through the years, but are you working now? What's the story?" And I said, "Wow, I'm actually transitioning at the moment. And yeah, I did finish design, and you know, here's my portfolio. It's not great, glamorous or anything, but here's where I've gotten to since you knew me as a 15-year-old.
Right, since the beginning.
It's the beginning. And then he's like, "Come over. We've got a major pitch on. We'll pay you for the week, but if we get it, we're up against 5 other agencies, big ones. And if we get it, then we'll talk." I do it, work with him for the week. We win. We win the pitch. And then I end up staying with him for 3 years under his wing. And he was my number one mentor, still is today in many, many ways. He showed me what good looks like as a leader, as a creative thinker and design thinking genius, and how to be and how to hold space and how to, you know, just how to operate as a business owner as well. So it's crazy how paths cross and how seeds, we don't know how or when they will grow when they're planted. So
true, man. And you know, life is full of moments like that where it's like sliding door moments. I was having this conversation earlier. It's like, if that one thing didn't happen, then what would the chain reaction be? And so a lot of chapters of your story have been written since then. Today, you're a human-centered designer. You're a decision-making coach. You're a creative strategist. You're a speaker. You're an author. You're passionate about mentorship. I bet you in no small part because of what Ian did for you. So I'm curious, and we're going to get into a lot of that. Let's first talk about design, because one of the things you say, and I love this, you say design has allowed you to ask better questions. So how has the lens of design allowed you to ask better questions?
I'll answer it in a few ways. The first thing is the shared vocabulary that we have of the word design traditionally skews towards the visual aspect, because even when I say it now, I'm a designer, people assume that I am in the realm of either graphic design or like, do you design visual identities like logos? Are you into fashion design? Are you into landscape design? It's skewed towards a visual reference, and they're anchored to that. But to your question, how design has helped me ask better questions, and how design can how that method of design thinking can help anyone ask better questions is this: design for me is reverse engineering a desired outcome, because you are applying a process, and that process is roughly in these sort of 4 buckets. There's the research component, where we're information gathering, because a key part of this is also never assuming, hence the asking better questions. So there's the research and the information gathering component. The second layer is around the defining, where we have everything there, all the territories, think of this as even like an affinity map. Okay, we've grouped these themes. Okay, we've gotten these research, we've gotten this data, we've got a whole array of sources there. Now, what are we actually wanting to do with this? Are we looking to solve a particular problem? If so, what? So then we define and we narrow down to the context and the brief in many ways. Then the third bucket is around the conceptualizing and designing part, in many ways, an MVP. So again, you can apply this, sure, to business. You can design a whole business. You can go as macro as designing a whole life for yourself if you apply this process. Or you can go ahead and design a product or a thing. But that's the third bucket, which is the more of the conceptualizing, the designing, the MVP, the prototype, the what does a minimum version of this look like. And then the fourth is distribute and deliver, deploy that into the world. And then you gather feedback again and you go back to the beginning. So there is this four-stage process, and a lot of this in any design discipline is never assume you know anything. Actually, oftentimes we have an unconscious bias when we make decisions and we don't ask enough questions. And so a lot of those titles that you listed there really stem back to one thing, which is what does the world need that you can give it? And whether you're a business or a brand, you know, and how that's played out for me has been the podcast or the writing or the speaking or the, you know, all of these things. But it really comes down to asking more questions in order for you to ensure that you are solving the right problems for the right people, or at least being informed by what's actually being said versus what we think is being said. Because there's a big difference between lived experience and observed experience. Mm-hmm. And this is the power of design. We're able to get hyper factual so that when we get the data, we analyze it, we synthesize it, we evaluate it, and then we arrive at key findings that's not subjective, or at least as little subjectivity as possible.
I think the key theme here is that we think and should think about design in terms of business outcomes. I interviewed Stephen Hoffman, who wrote an amazing book, and I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Make Elephants Fly. One of the things that stands out is how he highlights the importance of design. And so my background, I worked for Tesla. I was leader of a fairly large learning team within Tesla. So I trained all of the salespeople. So anyone that interacted with the customer, my team trained them. And fundamentally, if Elon didn't care to unbelievable level about the design, and I saw it happen time and time again, because I got my start at SolarCity. And so we were doing the solar roof shingles, our tiles. And, you know, first round of those came through and Elon did not like them because of the design. And so what Stephen Hoffman says in his book is just like, if you're going to get a few players, make sure you get a rock star designer. It's just so key. And if you're going to study something in school, study design. And so I think it's such an important thing. And having just interviewed Chris Doe and now interviewing you, design is on my mind. The other thing that's on my mind is mentorship, because I know that's something you're super passionate about. So I want to transition to that, because I love your framework about how you should at least start the process of finding a mentor. You kind of relate it almost to like dating, right? You don't want to go all in and ask somebody to marry you. Instead, you say, ask for advice first. So that's one piece of your framework. I wonder if you could elaborate on that and then just give the rest of the framework for how you think, because I mean, you've written a book about this, man. So how do you think others should go about finding mentors that will be best suited to help them on their journey?
Yeah. And it's funny because I included that a little bit in what I've just shared with the Ian Wingrove story. And a lot of the content, and I'm holding my book up for those listening, but yeah, it's called How to Get a Mentor as a Designer, but applicable for anyone, because here's how I put it. Firstly, success leaves clues. A lot of the information that I wrote and have written in my two books, fundamentally just what I wish someone taught me.
That, right.
Like, who knew that mentorship was not like a Harry Potter to Dumbledore or Frodo to whatever it is, like Gandalf. Who knew that it wasn't that, it was this lifelong thing? I didn't know. I thought it was one mentor, Billy. One. It's not that at all. So, all right. So here's the thing. I think that there are experts out there who have done what we ultimately want to do, because it's also important to understand that it's not necessarily that these people are more gifted or talented than us in a particular area of interest. It's just that they've played that game before over and over again, and hence why we can be mentors to someone else in a particular area. But mentors in a particular area of expertise, they're conditioned. And oftentimes we forget that these people that we praise in public have spent years and years practicing their craft in private. And navigating our way in professional life, personal life, whatever, it can leave us feeling lost, disappointed, and drained. But it doesn't have to be that way, because we can lessen the wrong turns because others have already done that. So for me, a mentor is someone that constructively guides, actively participates in supportive dialogue, and becomes a role model to a person less experienced, particularly in an area of personal or professional development. So they act as an advisor, they act as a friend, but they also act as an idol in many ways, someone that's proven to have done that thing. So I'll give four tips, basically. Firstly, you know, we need to get clear on the definition of what mentorship really is. So like I said, it's rarely this lifelong partnership thing. I think that's romanticized. So in my mind, the key thing is that you can have 10, 20, 40 mentors if you want, because a mentor interaction is simply those three aspects: the advice giving / the coaching piece, the friend who, you know, really knows that you feel that they're not after any ulterior motives, but then they've got proven knowledge. And so there's an interaction there, because the reality is, like, reading a book, watching a YouTube video, it's a one-way street. The power of mentorship is also in the dialogue. So the first thing is get clear that it can be a conversation as little as 10, 15 minutes. So that's what I want people to understand. The second tip is around going through a personal analysis. Because if you don't know who you are, so literally ask yourself, you know, who am I? What do I want? Why do I want it? What's stopping me from getting it? This is the foundation starting point for any endeavor, regardless of mentorship. But the beauty about doing this is when you go, right, I want to get into coding or design, or I want to buy a house in my 20s and invest. I mean, I had all these goals, right? But because I was so clear in articulating them, I was then able to pair, which is my third tip. You got to pair your goals with the right mentors. Mm-hmm. It's not a gamble. And this is where I think people get wrong when they look for mentors or anyone to help them. They don't actually strategically pair. And I'm talking this, like, if you've never seen, like me, when I started at Woolworths, which is a grocery company, I was a checkout operator, right? In Australia, I was 14, 9 months is when you can get your first job. 14, 9 months, I was scanning.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, whoa, I've got $80 this week. I never saw that. I never saw $80 when I was a teenager until I worked at Woolies. I was like, I'm going to get $500. I'm going to save up for my own guitar amp. I played a lot of guitar back then. I played in a band. So I was like, that was my goal. But the same thing applies. If you've never seen $10,000 in your bank account ever, find someone who has and ask them, how did you do it in whatever age that you're in? Let's say you're 18 and you've never seen $10,000. Seriously, go ask someone who has. And you're going to get so much insight. And that's important. And then I guess the fourth thing is understanding that. So number one is get clear on the definition. Number two, go through a personal analysis. Number three is pair your goals with the right people. And I guess number four would be around making sure that you are giving back and that you also are mentoring others. Because I tell you now, it's not an age thing. My 15-year-old cousin is like an insane coder. And he goes, yeah, I made this thing that you wanted to fix. And I'm like, how did you even do that? So we can learn a lot from each other, but yeah, there's certainly an importance of giving back. But if you want that, like a 12-step guide, which is available in paperback, ebook, and audio, I've written that for you and it outlines everything. It's how I got to people even like Kelly Slater, who has been on my show. The methods that I even get to reach these people, from Olympians to gold medalists to Shark Tank, Kevin O'Leary, he contacted me to interview him on my podcast, right? It's all in here. There's a method to it, but it is a lot like dating, as you said, Billy. Like, yeah. It's a process.
Yeah, man. I mean, look, if you have this illusion that there's one mentor for your entire life that will help you with everything you want to do, chances are they don't know how to be a mentor for everything you want to do, one. And then two, to your point, it starts with asking for advice, and that may lead to it being a mentor, and it may be a 10-minute conversation. The other thing that you do, which I really appreciate, is you help people get unstuck. And the way you do this is by helping them with their decision-making, because you feel, and I agree with this, that most people get stuck as a result of their inability to make a decision. So can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah. So I've got a framework, and you can go on ramcastillo.com, and I've got a framework. You can go to ramcastillo.com, because I found that as I now transition to coaching, advisory work, and consulting work, that the success really comes down to decision-making. Now, I know that might seem vague. It's like, well, yeah, of course, decision-making, it's so obvious. But really, there's a few parts to this which I found was like a pendulum swing. On one end, there's options overload. There's literally too many options. So what does that mean? Well, then you are met with analysis paralysis that we all too often know how that feels like. It's because you're stuck. So the stuck comes from, I don't know which to choose because there's too many options. Right. Then there's the other end, which is, I'm stuck because I don't even know where to start. I don't even know what my options even are. I don't even know what defines my decision-making compass, let alone what decisions I have. And so there's so different, true. there's stuck in those ways. So what I did was, and again, you can get this for literally, it's not even for free. It's literally, you don't even have to opt in or do anything. Just go on ramcastillo.com. I created a framework to help people with this. And I coached people through this as well as other frameworks that are involved. But it's called the lightning bolt method. And I want people to access empowered and informed rapid decision-making. So what we just said with the analysis paralysis piece, there's the options overload, and then there's also just prioritization challenges as well. It's a three Venn diagram thing, but it's just a three-step process, which is, I feel a lot of people are not in a shortage of dreams and wishes mm-hmm. and goals. I think a lot of people do know what they want, to be fair. But it's not just about defining what you want. It's about interrogating the actual objective. Defining, I think a lot of us have done and can do. You don't need coaching through that. We want a lot of stuff. Let's just be honest. We want to achieve a lot of things. But the interrogation, so interrogate your objectives, basically comes down to, what is the minimum viable intention? What is the intention, that the minimum version that if met, you can move on to the next phase of your development or your journey? So interrogate it down to the minimum. Number two is the need to curate the criteria. What do I mean by that? Just comes down to one thing. What is your non-negotiables? Or what are your non-negotiables? What will you say hell yes to? What will you say no to? Again, it might be super simplistic, but you literally go through this method, because I'll tell you one thing. I'll give you an example. One thing that helped me is I realized, and I created a 10-minute a day rule. Everything that I wanted, I put 10 minutes on it, because I realized that anything more than that, I'd cop out or I'd say some BS excuse. So again, what's your minimum? You fitness, you want to learn something? I wanted to learn magic. Odd. I was just like, I don't know, it's cool. I want to learn some magic tricks. I decided I wanted to get healthier and fitter. I decided I want to learn a new language. I decided I wanted to read more books. Guess what? I applied 10 minutes a day on each of them because I interrogated my objectives and I went down to the criteria and my non-negotiables were 10 minutes a day. I'm happy to do 10 minutes a day. And guess what? The 10 minutes eventually turned into 30 minutes often or 2 hours. That's how I wrote my first book. People are like, how did you write your first book? I did it this method. So I've packaged this up. So the curate criteria is number 2, which is what are your non-negotiables? The 3rd is dismantle obstacles. And that basically means what is the root cause of this? And you know what you'll find? Sometimes it's all in our head. Sometimes just
100%
fear or anxiety. And sometimes we just need to sit with it and we need to have a hard conversation with ourselves. What is the root cause analysis? That's the 3rd one, which is the dismantle. Pull it apart. Pull apart. What am I really fearing here? What is the real challenge here? That might even mean the mentor thing. You see, there's a formula to this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a formula to this. Has anyone ever felt this way? Well, go speak to someone. Don't do it alone. And so this is why I love helping people get unstuck in life, but predominantly focused in business, because I'm taking all the learnings that I've gotten from all the big brands in my 16-year career, and I'm giving all of that knowledge, and I want to be the access for people to know about human-centered design thinking, customer experience design. How do I design my customer experience? Do you know this, Billy? Most people haven't asked this fundamental question. Not most people, most business owners or aspiring entrepreneurs. How do I even acquire my customer? Where is my cash flow? What is my run rate? What is my projection? What is my validation of desirability, feasibility, all of that stuff? Doing the numbers, you know? So there's a lot there, but.
And the other thing, no, and I love it, man. And the other thing that people often don't do is distinguish between high value and low value activities. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how people can do this. And by the way, if you're serious about the magic thing and you're in LA, have you been to the Magic Castle yet?
No, but no.
Okay, you're coming and I'm taking you there, okay?
Done deal.
I took my mate from Melbourne there, so it's a tradition. So when you're in LA, let me know. I have a friend who has the ability to get us in there, and it's a invite only. It's pretty exclusive, but it's a sweet place to go watch magic. So that's side note. But okay, so high value versus low value activities. What can we do to better identify which is which?
All right. So effectively, it comes down to this: high value tasks are tasks that only you can do. Now, if you're listening, oftentimes we are doing things that other people can do and we can delegate to, but we choose to do it anyway because we have a belief that if it's not done by you, then it's simply not going to be successful. It's not going to be good. It's not going to be something that is faster or better. Low value tasks is what are the tasks that you can pay someone or delegate or have someone else do, because high value versus low is something that I wish again was taught, because the reality is a lot of the successful business owners and entrepreneurs that you see have a team behind it, and you have to let go of doing it all on your own. The high value task is also this: if you are the entrepreneur / business owner, then high value is actually building client relationships, building rapport and developing those relationships, nurturing them. It is about also nurturing your team and creating culture, a culture that's psychologically safe for people to perform. It's also about you showing what good looks like. It's also about you having a very clear vision and articulating that. Who's going to do that? Your senior designer? Oh, but they're senior. No, it's you. You have to understand that your value is in enabling people, in creating your vision to fruition. It's in business development, for crying out loud, right? Mm. So these are the high value tasks that I would advise for people who are stuck in going, I'm doing too much. Now, there's processes and systems to support you on this. I mean, firstly, Google Eisenhower matrix. It's the good old urgent versus important matrix. It's very, very common.
That's great.
Like, start there. Start there, number one. And because that's how I start my day. It's literally like brain dump onto a list, and then I get post-its if it's out of control. And then I literally am going, do I do this now because it's urgent and important? Do I delegate it? There you go. Yeah, exactly right, Billy. Do you delegate? Do later schedule or delete. And here's the other thing. Ask yourself this. Of my list, you know, Tim Ferriss has a version of this, which he calls the lead domino. What is the one thing that, if done, knocks a majority of your tasks as irrelevant or unnecessary, or just like it knocks them all to be done easier? The way I phrase it is more so around like, if I don't do this task, will my business still exist? That's a critical one. There's 80-20 rule as well, Pareto's principle. What is the 20% of things that do 80% of the results? But then also Parkinson's law, and I want to highlight Parkinson's law as a tool. Again, you can Google this stuff. This is all out there. But again, this is just real practical stuff, which I like to live in practicality a lot. It's Parkinson's law is the notion or the concept that task achievement, or the completion of a task rather, expands and contracts to the time allocated to it. So in short, we've all been high, most of us have been to school, you get the 2 weeks to do the essay. Did you spend every single day doing that essay? No.
Yeah,
you spent the night before. Yeah. If you're like me, maybe like, the day off. I don't know. Like,
Totally.
And so if you're in the office or if you've worked for someone else, I've been there where the deadline moved closer. And what did you do? How did your brain work? It does this funny thing where it just culls out the unnecessary stuff and it does the critical in your brain. It's just happening. So I'm telling you, if you've given yourself 3 days to do something, try doing it in a day. Just try. Shift the deadline forward. And here's the thing, because a lot of this is linked with procrastination. And how I define procrastination is this. Procrastination exists if a choice exists. Remove the choice down to one option. So these are a few things, high value versus low. It's all linked.
I love it, man. Super practical. And to wrap up, I have one final question for you about fear. And what you say is fear is false constructs based on untested assumptions. Can you explain that insight? I think that would be a great way to end.
Okay, so a few things with that. And thanks for bringing that up. So for me, I've found that, and I think we can all relate to this, it's only scary until you've done it. And the beauty about what I've just shared to you about the design process is the test and iterate cycle. So I want you to apply that to your life. And I want people to understand that there's this thing called exposure and conditioning. It's exposure therapy. The more you expose yourself to something, I've even written this in my book and as a funny joke, because again, right, I wasn't the football jock, but I always thought, how are they so confident? They're I was in high school. I even have this memory of the football jock. He would be around like five girls and he would have all their attention. And I'll be like, how is this guy doing that? But let's take it further. How does a stripper, right, a male stripper, let's say, hold himself and just be like, this is just another day in the office? I mean, I'll just be honest with you, right? Like, it's because of the exposure and conditioning. And I think that there's something in that. And that's why when I say, I don't know why I ended up using that example. But the reality is whether you're pitching, whether you're speaking in front of an audience.
It's a good example.
We're going all out here, Billy. No, but
let's end on male strippers.
That's it. That's it. No, look, you know, whatever you want to do, it only feels impossible until it's done. It's all that. You don't need me to get Tony Robbins on you. But like the fear is really just an untested assumption. In your mind, you feel that it's scary. It's always unknown. But here's the thing. When the pain, I think I am going to get Anthony Robbins on it. When the pain of remaining the same is greater than the pain of changing, that's when you know. So you got to go. Because, you know, time is not a renewable resource. And the time you spent pondering could have been the time you spent doing. It's all that stuff. But yeah, there you go.
Well, the pain pleasure principle is real. And Ram, I'm so, so excited to have had this conversation with you. And for those that want more, because clearly you have so much to offer, and thank you for sharing. I know ramcastillo.com, as well as your books, How to Get a Job as a Designer Guaranteed, How to Get a Mentor as a Designer Guaranteed, your podcast, Giant Thinkers. Of course, you're on all the social media platforms. I met you on Clubhouse. I listened to you and I was like, man, I have to have this guy on my show. But definitely go check out the Giant Thinkers, most of your social media handles. Where else can they go to find out some great things? I know you have some courses and some other things. Where else can they find all the goodness you put out into the universe?
Yeah, well, the central hub would be ramcastillo.com, definitely. Giantthinkers.com as well, which is more the podcasting. And I've got the books. I mean, you can, depending on what you need, I've also got Creative Live courses. I've got two courses on Creative Live, the world's largest online learning platform. One's called Create a Knockout Design Portfolio. The other one's called Get the Dream Design Job You Want. But yeah, like if you're after mentorship, just, you know, if you want more of that, you can just, you can grab the ebook on Amazon or paperback if you prefer. Audio is also available. But I really just want people to take action, and I want them to know that they have the practical tools and frameworks. I don't want people to feel like it's only for the few, or because I was that, and this is what I want. So I want people to take action and to stop living in their head and to start getting into the action piece. But connect with me on Instagram, because that's where I connect with so many people. It's fast, it's easy, and I'd love to get a hello from you and see where you are on your journey.
Well, I love it. Well, I want to give you the final word, and I'm going to share a quote that will allow you to either expand upon it. Here it goes. Keep painting the world with your colors and remember where you came from.
Ooh, that brings me back, mate. That was in a lonely period of my life where my mom sent me that text during Christmas and New Year's Eve period, my first ever Christmas and New Year's Eve alone. And I was needing something, and I didn't even ask for anything. I literally just sent my family a message, just a typical Merry Christmas message. And instead of saying Merry Christmas back, my mom sent me that. Keep painting the world with your colors and remember where you came from. It's for everyone, really.
Will you keep doing what you're doing to paint the world your colors, and don't forget where you came from. Ram Castillo, thank you for being on Inside Out.
Thank you so much, Billy. That was amazing. Love you, mate. Cheers.